All right. I don't know where this is going to be an interesting pre-show because I don't know where the pre-show is going to begin and where, but where the pre-show is going to end and the show is going to begin. But what I want to do on this show today, because it is Memorial Day, and I'm just letting you guys in on my thinking, do something different. You know, Memorial Day is generally a weekend day, and you have to look at the way people perceive days. You've heard me give this speech before. If you haven't, it's a very short, quick primer on how we look at the days of the week when in broadcasting, podcasting. I think it's probably similar, but I don't know. Some people say that podcasting use goes up on weekends. Am I right about that? I don't know. It's kind of interesting. But what I do is just, and that may be the mistake that I'm making here. That may be the mistake I'm making. You know, I mean, I may instead of doing I should be doing regular shows on the weekends and doing Elcott and doing our chat and all that shit on the weekdays. I don't know. So all I'm trying to do is get by. Basically, I'm just trying to make a living here, and that is what we do here. Now, our podcast, broadcast, et cetera, that we do is, it's a professional offering, you know, and we make our living this way. That's how that's done. I don't know about anybody else. I wish everybody the best of the world to each and every one of their endeavors, but that's what we do. And so we endeavor to create something different. And, you know, I could get into a whole big, long discussion, which I've done many times in my life, about how come you do what you do when you do and you don't do what the other people do. And I'm not saying that everybody else is cookie cutter, not by a long shot. Everyone's different, and great success is had by so many folks in so many different ways. But I've never been a guy that was good at interviewing. I've never been a guy that was good at doing the five-man or six-man or morning zoo thing, because I always had a very specific idea of how I wanted the show to work, you know, how I wanted it to sound, how I wanted it to be. And so I realized that it's a control thing. I don't know whether that's a weakness or not. It's definitely a control thing. I want to control each and every element. And actually, what I wanted to do was to, let's put it into terms that a teenager would use, I want to make fun of that stuff I hear. I want to make fun of all that shit that I'm listening to. How do I make fun of all that shit? Well, you can get some actors and do that. Yeah, that means I got to pay them. I'm on their schedule. See what I'm saying? I don't know if I want to do that. Well, then you have to do it by yourself. All right. I could pretend I'm those other people. So I did that, and that seemed to be not enough at a time when we had a thing called talk radio. You know? And there's so much to make fun of and so much to mock. Now, for the first 17 years of my career, all I was doing was being a disc jockey. I was trying to do the disc jockey thing, which was play records and be respectful of them and like them and enjoy them and then drop a bunch of funny comments in between the songs and use sound effects, what we call drops. You guys have heard drops. That's a sound effect, or that's something that they play in the middle of a rap, you know. It's a sound effect or something like that. For instance, something that would go along the lines of, I'm starting to find one here. Oh, you know, like a belch, okay? So, I see that Bob's visiting today. Bob, what did you, looks like you just ate something. Oh my God, don't do that in the microphone. You know. There are a lot of great ones that I grew up listening to, cats that use drops. Emperor Hudson, Bob Hudson was great. And then the real Don Steele had just one drop. I think he just had one, bless his heart. Sean Steele, his widow, she could probably think of some others, but he had Tina Delgado was alive. And then you say, like, all right, it's time, you know the ratings? Yeah, dive, man, that's what they did, that kind of shit. But that's wore out. I didn't do it as well as other people, and it sucked, and it wasn't funny. So after getting fired from my last disc jockey gig, I just decided, you know, I'm going to have to be Phil Hendry. And that was a guy that I'd been resisted being for a lot of years, and for various psychological reasons, and reasons having to do with self-image and, you know, so and self-acceptance, all kinds of bullshit. What keeps you guys? Well, I don't want to bring you into it, but it keeps anybody from being the person that they would like to be. And as Trevor Duvall said, the great voice talent, talking with us one day, we were sitting waiting to go in to record our, you know, record for F is for Family. You know, we were talking about why we do what we do. He says, you know what, bottom line is, don't do what you want to do. Do what you're good at. I'll never forget that as long as I live. That's the greatest single piece of advice I have ever heard when it comes to profession, work, etc. Don't do what you love. Do what you're good at. Because here's a news flash. What you're good at is most likely what you love. Why would you be good at it? I don't know. I'm really good at being a carpenter. And you hate it, huh?
Yeah.
Bullshit. Don't tell me you hate it. Yes, you do love it. You just don't like, you don't like the money that you make at it. You got to figure a new way of making more money at that. All right. So what I was good at was these acting, I guess. I'm not calling myself Laurence Olivier. I'm not even calling myself Scott Baio. I mean, it's what it is. You're acting. You're creating a character, and you're performing that character. What the hell else do you call it?
Well, you're doing voices.
Yeah, all right. I guess people that act on screen are doing people, but it's the same thing. You know, I'm doing a face. You're doing more than a voice. You're doing a lot. If you're doing a character, you're doing a lot more than just the voice. You're bringing a lot more to the character than you... than just the voice. Otherwise, it wouldn't sound as good as it does. Anyway, so I started doing that. I don't know why I'm giving you the history of what we do here, but I think I feel like I need to, because it's a... it's like, you know, bringing me here to this present moment. Bring me here to this time and place that we're at now. The other reason why I'm doing the show the way I'm doing it today is I'm fasting because I've been on this diet, but yesterday, Lauren and I went up to the Ojai Valley Inn and spa, and we didn't do any spawing. We didn't do any sparring. We just went into the restaurant because I said, well, you come up to Ojai. She's never been to Ojai. Let's take a look at Ojai. It's cool. And she didn't dig. It was funny about Lauren. She didn't dig it. She said, well, oh, I like how artsy it is, all this good stuff. She said, I wouldn't live up here for $1 million. I said, I would. What are you talking about? She said, maybe it reminds her too much of Oklahoma. I don't know. But we did go into the hotel. We had a lunch. I had a fantastic lunch. I had a turkey sub sandwich. It's like, God damn, it was good, man. And these potato chips that they served up, those kettle chips, God, they were unreal. So there I go. I blew my diet out. And I was already a few calories over, so I said, well, tomorrow I gotta fast all day, which is what I'm doing right now. I'm drinking lemon juice, and I'm drinking water and lemon juice. So I figured I'd do this kind of a show because it takes a little less energy, because I ain't got the energy to do a full show, and it is Memorial Day. And if I didn't already, I think I might have a shout-out to my brother, Dara, who's a veteran. Now, today is Memorial Day. It means you are remembering those that have died in service to the country in war. And also just all of our military members who passed on. So, no, this is not exactly a day that I should be bringing up my brother Dara, but, you know, we thought we'd lost him back in the summer when he had all kinds of problems, complications from diabetes. Serious stuff, man. He almost lost his leg. Almost lost his foot, at least. They're going to try to limit it to the foot. Well, he almost lost his leg. Right. Well, I think all we need is the foot. Oh, that's great. Yeah. But no, nothing. And he was on a respirator. He was, they had to put him on that deep, it's an anesthetic that has been abused in the past. You know the drug, but they had to put him on that to keep him sleeping and let his body rest. It was, we thought that he would come out of that probably not 100% mentally. It was really weird and very nerve-wracking. But when he finally got his health back, he was 100%. And what I mean by that is faculties, 100% faculties and stuff. So we might have lost him last summer, and we'd be talking about him today on Memorial Day. And no, we're not. So that is a really cool thing. So anyway, today being Memorial Day, and a day that is a kind of a weekend day, that's why we want to do this kind of a show, a kind of a weekend show. Now, getting back to, you know, the evolution of the show, it is, and it's, this is good for me to kind of tell you about it, because a lot of you guys don't even know who the hell I am. You know, like Jack Nicholson in Five Easy Pieces, he don't even know who the hell I am. And when I got into the real throes of doing a creative show, the first thing I wanted to do was satirize talk radio. Talk radio sounded, and still sounds to me, just asinine. Just utterly asinine. There isn't a goddamn thing I've ever learned from listening to a talk radio show, unless, of course, it was, you know, listening to a medical advice show, some stuff like that. But these shows are so skewed, and the choir is being sung to and preached to, and it's just a circle jerk. You know, there's nothing to learn. And the information is very shallow. It's oftentimes wrong. All kinds of bullshit repeated as if it's fact. It's I'm talking about, it doesn't make any difference what side of the political aisle or the political divide is. That's what it is. And I just thought it was ripe for being made fun of. And one day I was listening to KABC, and I was listening to this cat named Billy Pearl. Billy used to be a top 40 jock. And Billy transitioned into doing a talk show on KABC. He used to be a top 40 jock on KHJ. Then he became a talk show host. And he was reading... He was reading something. I don't know whether it was actually pre-printed or something that he wrote. But he was reading both parts. And one was a journalist, and the other was Saddam Hussein responding to this journalist's questions. And Billy had a voice. It was a little bit more higher pitched than mine. It kind of sounded like this. But he, and I'm not mocking him. I'm trying to give you the idea of it. He was asking, and what are you going to do with the protesters in your society? And the response coming from Saddam Hussein was put through a filter of some kind. Let's say that this was the filter. So he's saying, and what are you going to do with protesters in your society? Well, I am going to imprison them and eventually bring them up on charges. So I don't know why he was doing this, but it was, I don't know. It was, maybe it was his way of bringing to life the actual thinking and the actual thinking and speaking of Saddam Hussein. It was very, very seriously rendered, though, and it was an attempt to illustrate something having to do with Saddam Hussein and perhaps, you know, and his government and the Ba'ath Party. I don't know. It was during the buildup to the Gulf War, which was called Desert Shield. All those troops were being sent over to the Middle East. And it was quite new in American history for this generation. The last time we had a major buildup of troops anywhere was Vietnam back in the 60s, and it was very, very slow. And then before that, you'd have to say it was World War II with the troops landing in England getting ready for D-Day. Probably there hadn't been anything quite like what was happening before Desert Storm since D-Day. Literally, everybody knew the troops were going over there, and everybody knew that there was an invasion of Europe that was about to happen. And so that was the thinking, and that was the times. You know, that's what was being sort of felt. And I heard that. I went, oh, I could play two characters. I can easily do that. I've been doing it to myself. I never did it really professionally, except the last 6 months I was on KLSX. And KLSX was a classic rock station that I had been doing Morning Drive on, and then they shifted me over to weekends. I probably should have just quit. I probably, you know, it's kind of humiliating, man, to go from Morning Drive and now you're the goddamn, you're a weekend host? Holy shit. And I was feeling the kind of the humiliation of that. And one night, I was doing the overnight show, and one night I just started going into character on air without the aid of pre-taping, without the aid of multi-tracking, just doing that kind of shit that I do now, which was, well, how are you doing?
Well, I'm very good, and
Welcome to KLSX.
Well, thank you.
Are you
I'm just emptying a garbage can. I didn't know you could put me on the air.
Well, I thought I would, because I don't have any guests or anything.
Well, I don't think I make much of a guest, but well, sit down. Okay.
That kind of shit. And then I left KLSX, I think I was ultimately fired. You know, my career as a disc jockey just really went from fairly promising, the high point probably being mornings at KLSX, all the way down into the toilet within a year and a half span. And then I latched on to KFI doing weekends as a talk show host on KFI, but that didn't go anywhere. That was me going back to my old ways of, let me just do this by the book. Let me do this by the numbers. Let me bring in a guest. Let me interview people on abortion and bullshit like that. And what would happen? I'd get fired. And you'd wonder, why did I get fired? I mean, I know I got fired because it sucked, but God damn it, if I'm going to get fired, let me get fired, be fired doing something that I'm proud of. So I, long story short, I decided I was going to do, no matter what I did, something I could be proud of. I was going to do what I loved or what I was good at. Let's put it that way. And I didn't know it at the time. And I started doing characters. Well, I'm listening to Billy Pearl doing this thing, this one weekend show on KBC. So I went back to KVEN that weekend. And KVEN was, or that week, I should say, KVEN was the station I got hired to work at in Ventura around 1990. And that's when I started being me, to put it as succinctly as and as dull as possible. That was it. And I went back and I started to do this Raj Fanian voice, you know, like this. And rather than have him be interviewed by the real Phil, me, I just came on the air as Raj Fanian. I said, I'm filling in here today for Phil Henry, and I hope you will give me a chance here on the KVEN, and welcome to the KVEN, this kind of shit. Okay. Because I had absolutely nothing to lose. What was I going to do? Go back to being a disc jockey? There was only one thing I could have done at that point. And probably in terms of job security, I should have done it, which was I could have gone and gotten a gig at one of those adult contemporary stations. And I'm not putting down that work at all. Please understand, it's a legitimate gig, you know. I could have gone to an adult contemporary station and I could have shifted down into sex gear and started talking like this. You're listening to The Light Hits. All right, let's listen to Michael McDonald now in Sweet Freedom here on Light Hits 97. I could have done that fucking that stuff in my sleep, man. And throughout the 90s, they were paying huge money to do that shit. I mean, huge. I mean, the cat that was doing mornings at The Wave was making about 700, 800 grand a year just doing that. Now, you throw in voiceover and you know, commercial work. Now, the radio business has changed. The money has gone out of it. So, yeah, I'm talking about a different era. But the fact of the matter is, 1990, I could have gone to work in a major market for a light hit station and made some serious dollar. And I could have done that shit for 15 years, man. But instead, what I did was, because I'm Mr. whatever the hell I think I am,
no, I'm going to have integrity and be an artist.
I started doing the show that I became known for, which was to do these character voices and to sucker the casual, active caller. Big difference between a caller and a listener. Huge difference between a caller and a listener. People who know me and people in the business have heard me give this speech many times. And obviously, I learned this from my programmers, specifically David Hall, who did all kinds of research, and it was the guy who said, you know, you only got 2% of your audience is going to call, man. And of that 2% of the audience that's going to call, you are looking for an even smaller percentage. And these are people that are going to believe the character that you're doing. But we found them. Okay. And we sort of milked that and refined it, too. I got better at it and better at it as the years went on. From the days at KVEN where we only did it occasionally and the rest of it was just monologuing and not even as structured as it is today. Today, I've got all these different characters and we basically structure it like it's a real show, some kind of a weird talk show where you've got a panel of idiots and I'm ready to kill everybody, you know, which to me is kind of the best way to approach satirizing media or that kind of radio. Just make it something that's on the edge. Make it something that's ready to spin out of control at any minute because everyone is straining against the constraints and they want to flip out on it. So wherever the hell I was. So anyway, like I was saying, here's Anthony. Excuse me for stopping down. Anthony Bourdain's on now and he's shoveling more garbage into his puss. I don't know what he's in some country where he's sitting down and eating with the natives, as if, you know, he backpacked his way into that scene and is now just parked his ass there at the table with, you know, these Aboriginal people and hi, do you mind if I eat goat? No, not at all. Please sit down with us and we'll talk earnestly with you. Thank you. I have that effect on people. Anyway, so, I wouldn't be giving him all this shit were it not for the fact that that motherfucker, forget it. I don't think it matters, dude, whether you stand there and watch the animal being killed that you're going to eat. At least I'm going to watch that animal be killed. What the fuck? He still killed it. Anyway, we did that, and you got a very small percentage of people are going to call. Now, we get nationally syndicated. And I found out something. And I hadn't even thought about this, but I found out through the experience of being nationally syndicated by this major syndicator, by this major network, that my show was really distinct from talk radio. I had never thought, I realized that I was doing something different from all the other guys on the talk stations that I was on, but being syndicated, you're removed from the lineup of a daily radio show, and you're in a show that they're trying to park places. And the logical thinking is, let's park it on talk stations. It's very logical. I don't knock it at all. Where else are you going to go? The show is a slow build. The show, when you listen to the old show, you would hear it very slowly. The monologue would roll out slowly, and you had to do two things. And these are things that I began to concentrate and focus more on because there was a weakness in the opening monologues, and it was the following thing. You have to roll the monologue out slowly to sell to the casual listener that you want to have calling that it's real. But when you roll it out slowly, you get to the humor. It takes a lot longer to get to the humor, which is not something that the listener who's never going to call, just some cat who's turning on the radio to be entertained, it's not something that he's going to want to hear. He wants to, where are we going here? So you had to make it interesting, or at least you had to make it, especially people that knew it was me doing a voice, you had to make it funny, and at the same time, you had to make it credible for people to call. And I wasn't really concentrating on that until we got onto the national stage. And I realized, well, now, and why was I doing that? Because we were increasingly getting this feedback from stations. Well, he's not beast or fowl. He's not a beast. And I would say, well, if they don't get it, if a program director doesn't get it, if the guy that is actually is putting my show on his station doesn't get it, then what the fuck am I doing? You know, why are they, this is not brain surgery. If you talk about professionals, these are professionals, they don't know what it is. So we found that there was this resistance, and there was also an inability for them to promote it properly, to market it properly. They didn't quite know what to do with it. We would tell them, well, it's like Saturday Night Live. Saturday Night Live is on a network. Let's say Saturday Night Live is on a station that also has legitimate news. Well, yeah, but it's... It should have been either really super marketed as a distinct thing, but it was on late nights. And when it was on late nights, it's just not a high dollar portion of the radio show or the radio broadcast day. Prime time is morning drive and afternoon drive. Should have been somewhere 6A to 6P. Or it should have been its own format. We should have had surrounding my show other comic, other funny shows. Now, we did that at WIOD. It had huge numbers. Huge numbers. And I pushed for that. I said, you know what? You guys ought to be in the business of. And I was working for Clear Channel at the time before it was iHeartMedia. I said, why don't you guys create a format and put and create stations? Take some stations that are, you know, losing money. I don't know what. And create a format of personality talk so that it's not just my show, but it's also a lot of other guys, you know, that do personality-driven talk shows. Personality talk, not news talk, personality talk, meaning the focus is really on the host. Now, as far as my show goes, only the callers that don't know what the fuck it is I'm doing wouldn't be in on it. Everybody else would. Anyway, that was, you know... That was an idea. But as we moved on through the process and my contract was up at Clear Channel and I got out into the big bad world all by myself and I went to work for another syndicator that wasn't even one-tenth as good as Premier's effort was, something else was happening, and that was social media was beginning to explode. MySpace was happening. Then came Twitter in 2008, 2009. Then came Facebook, and then bang. And then all of a sudden, radio, not only talk radio, but the entire idea of radio began to look a little superfluous. And the next thing you know, all of the pissed off attitude that a talk show caller was going to bring to talk radio, he could put on Facebook. He doesn't have to call up and wait for the host to get to him and negotiate a screener and negotiate the host and all of his bullshit until he can finally spit out what he wants to say, and he doesn't know when he's going to get hung up on anyway, and he's really angry, and he's, you know. Instead, he can just create his own Facebook page, and he can put any shit that he wants on the Facebook page and say anything that he wants, and he can just, you know, and he's talking to his audience. It may not be big enough. He may only have five friends, but hey, guess what you got to do? You got to learn how to market yourself. It becomes a lesson in public presence, in personality. Everybody can become a commentator slash personality slash entertainer. YouTube has proven that over and over and over again to the extent that it's got these new YouTube stars, right? You have people with millions of followers. Same thing with Facebook. Same thing with Twitter. Twitter has created stars. Rob Delaney. Kelly Oxford. So, you know, talk radio. And then on top of everything else, we are now, and I think we're passing through it a little bit, but we have... we entered into the era of the prankster, the era of the jokester, the era of pranking, as they like to call it, which was a play on the word cranking, which we used to call it in radio. Crank callers. Prank callers. Pranks. Everybody's goofing everybody. Punked. All kinds of shit, man. Everybody's doing a goof. Everybody's creating fake profiles. Everybody's creating fake profiles to really suck people in. There's that North Korean news agency one that's on Twitter that I love. It's funnier than hell. And lesser and greater of those, right? So continue to do what I was doing, which was, when I did it, it was an absolutely unique first-time event on radio. On radio, you know, I mean, Alan Funt with Candid Camera, yeah, but I don't think anybody, even in television, I don't think anybody had created characters that seriously drew the joke out as long as we did and had as much real-time reaction, you know. Keep in mind, that was a live presentation, and it was real-time, and it was all of the mistakes as well as the triumphs were to be heard on the air. I go back and listen to those old shows, and I'm like, some of them are embarrassingly bad. And here's the other thing about the old show, just so I can, you know, wrap this up, because I don't want to go reminiscing, but I have to say these things because I got a lot of people who still don't understand. It was never, ever a breakout commercial success. Not on the level of like Howard's show, Limbaugh, or any of those. Not even close. It always struggled for advertisers. Always struggled for revenue, you know, stations to clear. We were constantly fighting to stay on stations, constantly fighting for revenue. We didn't have anybody, and I always used to say, it isn't that the show is not a show that is going to, you know, isn't going to deliver listeners for an advertiser. It's that I don't think we have anybody selling the show that knows how to sell this particular show. And we had some good salespeople, but it's a completely different animal, you know. And nobody wants to really, you know, if you've got a bunch of other shows that are doing better, you're going to concentrate on those, man. You're going to sit there and go, how can we make Phil Hendry? Because in radio, unlike probably any other business, either you're a bust-out star. In other words, either you make things real easy for the people that are, you know, supporting you, or they just don't want to support you. They don't work all that hard at the higher levels, at the management levels in radio. They may think they do. They may go home at night bitching and pissing and moaning about the on-air talent and this and that and something else. You know, I got no sympathy for those guys. I know how hard we work, and they got to tell me they work their asses off, whatever. But the fact of the matter is they couldn't sell it. So, and it was never a bust-out commercial success. It didn't have the ratings. Because I think it was not in the right place. It could have been, I think, a much, much higher rated entity had it been in an environment that was a lot more conducive. So that brings us to the show that we do now. People will say, man, I sure miss it when you took phone calls. Yeah, me too. But why don't you try some more? You know, we could, man. But there's got to be something more to do with it than just that. Otherwise, it's like I'm going back and doing the old show again. And I, you know, I'm now digital. And people use the internet differently than the way they use the radio. First of all, people are far more savvy and far more educated as to what it is they're listening to. And people are on-demand listeners now. They're not live listeners the way they used to be. So listening to a product live on the internet is much more rare an occurrence than it was in the days of radio. Today, it's all about on-demand. That's why. Why do you think NBC, for instance, is televising? What the hell were they televising that one time? What the hell was Snow White or something like that? I don't know what it was. Some TV show. Some I play, but they did it live. Peter Pan, right? Was that it? And Sound of Music. They did that live. Why? They want to know what would bring an audience to live TV again. What will bring an audience to, I shouldn't say live, what will bring an audience to appointment listening again as opposed to on demand? Meaning it's 9 o'clock, I got to go home, I got to watch this thing. It's 11:30, I got to go home, I got to watch Saturday Night Live, which is the way it was when I was in my 20s, when Saturday Night Live first hit the air. You'd be in a bar at about 11:20, you'd look at the clock and go, we got to go home. Because for some reason, most of these bars didn't show Saturday Night Live. You know, can you believe it? A lot of them did, but a lot of them didn't. And at that time, when Saturday Night Live went on the air, I was on the air in Orlando, Florida. Not what I would call the most, you know, aware market at the time, but hey, just to give an example, when I was on the air in Orlando, I said the word schmuck on the air. This was 1974. I want to tell you right now, I could say schmuck on the radio in New York and L.A. probably during that period. And it might not have gone over 100%, but in Orlando, they really had a goddamn conniption over that. I didn't even know what the hell they were talking about, not speaking Yiddish, but certainly aware of the more popular sayings and phrases and words and that kind of thing. It's what it, that means prick. Did you know that? Schmuck is prick. No, I didn't know that, but hey, sounds good to me. Oh, we can't have that. they flipped out on that one. So anyway, the appointment viewing and listening of the old days has changed radically, and now you have this on-demand listening. On-demand just kills any idea. Now, it isn't that I don't think about it every now and again. It isn't that we don't have different ideas on how to work it every now and again, and we will continue to. But until then, man, you know, I would much rather continue to explore what we can do here as podcasters as opposed to how I can return to something else that I was doing. I want to know how I move forward and not go backward. So, you know, what we do on our show, you've heard it, is very different from a lot of other podcasts that are on, most of which are basically your format of an interviewer and a guest. And they sort of all mirror that model. And I'm not saying that mine is completely unique, but what we try to do on our show is just fucking, you know, present a show, you know, a theatrical how you doing, folks? You know, and come out, and then off we go at the end of the show, and that's the end of that. There's a lot of people that we've brought over from the radio to our podcast, which I think is a good thing. But I have noticed that we have a lot of people who have come over to listen to me who don't know really all that much about podcasts. I like Phil. Where do I find him? He's over here. Okay, I'll go there. And they listen and go, what is this? What do you mean podcast? And why is the show only an hour? And this and that and this and that. Because they're kind of unfamiliar with it's a completely different delivery and way of presenting something. First of all, when you're doing all the characters, like I do, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 voices, 8 voices per show, that's, I got to tell you something, man, that takes a lot of energy. I don't know whether you know it or not, but it just does. And you ain't going to do 3 hours that way. I did it for a while, my old radio show, before we just went off the air when my contract was up and I couldn't wait to get the F out of where I was. 3 hours a night I was doing it. And you say, well, why weren't you asking for phone calls? I was. Up until about 2011, I was beating my brains out trying to get phone calls. And they just weren't there. And I know the reason. The show was getting fewer and fewer live clears, meaning we were on fewer and fewer stations that were carrying us live. They were what's called DBing, delayed broadcast. That's number one. Number two, we were in fewer and fewer large markets. We were in small, many, many, many small markets. Very few active callers. It was just absolutely the worst possible situation. And if you think that I'm blaming other people for all of this stuff, please, I don't blame anybody. I take this on myself that I did not see the environment changing. I should have, when I left in 2006, I should have stayed out of radio until podcasting came along. I was working along, doing other stuff, acting, voiceover. It was going fine. You know, I was making a decent living, but I got so bored, because you sit around on your ass half the time waiting for somebody to call you, that I wanted to get back on the air, and I was listening to radio, and radio hadn't gotten any better. It was still just a sack of shit. That I jumped at the first opportunity to nationally syndicate the show. Absolute terrible decision. Believe me when I tell you, folks, I made a lot of bad decisions in my life. Lots and lots. But I did what I did, and here we are. And this is a show that takes a lot of energy. I don't mind it at all. But you aren't going to do 3 hours. You can't do 3 hours. It's ridiculous to do 3 hours. Why? You're just going to be trying to squeeze water out of a dry sponge, man. It's like you squeezed all the water out an hour ago, man. There's nothing left. So we do 50 minutes to an hour. And then we change it up with characters hosting and then me hosting with other characters and things like that. So it's like a theatrical presentation. So that's how our show came about. And I enjoy doing it like that. It's a lot of work. So as I mentioned earlier, one of the reasons why I'm doing the show the way I'm doing it right now, today, is because I'm on this diet. And I busted all the calories out yesterday, Saturday, when Lauren and I went up to the Ojai Valley Inn and had some lunch. And it was fantastic, and I loved it. And then, you know, man, we really partied last night. We were having a few cocktails and watching the Oklahoma City Golden State Warrior game. And tequila is only 90 calories per ounce. It's not too bad. 180, I usually drink a double. And if you throw that damn ginger beer into it, which occasionally we still make that Moscow or that Mexican Mule, that's a 280-calorie drink. Have two of those, that's 560 calories. That's on top of what we did eating. So I just decided I got to fast all day Sunday. It's got to, you know, not eat anything, and that's what I'm doing. But because of that, there's not a as much energy maybe as I might ordinarily have. You there? Let's see. So there's that. Now the other thing that's going on here at the homestead is I'm tearing out the carpeting. I'm getting rid of that god-awful, funky, stank shit. And we're going to put in wood, or if you will, laminate, or if you will further, the new Paradigm has a new flooring that is, I believe, vinyl. But it looks like wood, and it's a beautiful thing. Now, I'm not going to put hardwood floors in a house that's a block and a half from the beach. Ain't gonna happen. It's an expense. And you put that kind of bread into a house that's a block and a half or two blocks from the beach, and the next thing you know, you may have hardwood floors, but they look like shit as the moisture and everything else that comes with sand, everything else that comes with that. And by the way, I got a nice house. But it's not, you know, a multi-billion dollar spread, man. It's a cool house. It's what I call an IKEA furniture house. You know, my house looks really good with IKEA furniture in it. My house looks really good with laminate floors, as opposed to, I don't need to do any of that other stuff. Because I look out the window and I see there's the Pacific Ocean. I don't give a damn if I'm walking on paper, you know. I look out my window, and there's the El Pacifico. So what we're doing here is we're going to tear out all this crap that we've got, this carpeting. I can't take it. I'll never live in another house with carpeting as long as I live. I can't stand that shit. Stinks. Looks like hell. It doesn't serve any purpose whatsoever other than for dogs and cats to shit and pee on. And then it gets kind of, you know, you clean it up, but then it's still, and somewhere here on this carpet that you may be sitting or standing on, a dog once took a huge dump. Really? I don't see it. Well, you know, trust me, we tried to scrub it out as good as we could. And every 6 months you're bringing in Charlie there with the steam cleaner, and you know, so forget it, man. So we're going to put in this longboard. And then I'm throwing out all the furniture that I have. It's going into the garbage, or it'll go to Goodwill, wherever. I don't know, whoever wants it. I don't know. I don't want to offend anybody. It turns out, you know, you may know this, but some places that we traditionally thought of as places that you would give a lot of this stuff to, they don't want a lot of this shit. Because they don't want to, they're not the dump, you know, and I understand. Goodwill has, I remember a couple times they've said, no, sir, we don't want to take your, I don't know what we had, like a corroded barbecue. No, we're not miracle workers here, and we're not the city dump, you know, so I don't blame them. I gave a car to Salvation Army once, a car. I gave them my Blazer my 85 Blazer when I was in Miami and gave it away to them. Got the tax write-off, $500, and I talked about it on the air, and hopefully I gave other people the idea, you know, you can do that. If you got a car you want to get rid of, you want to sell it, okay, fine, but I didn't give a shit. I needed to get rid of the car. I needed a new car. And so the very good people from Salvation Army in Miami came by and they took the car off my hands. My Blazer. I wonder where it is now. Has it been cannibalized for its parts? It was a long time ago, you know. 20 years ago. So, you know, Goodwill, St. Vincent de Paul, Salvation Army, etc. And I've got this furniture, so we'll either throw it in the garbage or we will give it to those cats. And we're going to refurnish the whole house, probably in good old-fashioned, funky, goofy, crazy IKEA. And, you know, some other things. We got some stuff that we're going to keep, but mostly that. And some throw rugs. And make this place start to look like a freaking beach house, you know, a place where you come and kick and you're comfortable and you're not laying in a stain of dog shit. Now, there's that. The big project, which will begun, we will begin it this summer, and I'm hoping that it goes swimmingly. The big project, and this is one that I've been thinking of and dreaming about for years. Where I live, along the Channel Islands beach, there's lots and lots of houses that have rooftop decks. Even the cats that live right on the sand have got rooftop decks. Right, literally, go up the stairs, you're on the roof, it's a deck, a barbecue, a hot tub, a wet bar, places for people to sit, chaise lounge, chairs, etc. I said, I want that. Because even dudes that are three or four or five houses back from the beach or a block back from the beach, they've got these rooftop decks. My friend Mark, I went over to his house on one of the streets here, and he had the last house on the street at the other end of the beach. I mean, at the opposite end of the street. So he was the furthest away from the sand. We got up to the roof of his house. Man, it was fantastic. Beautiful view. In fact, it was almost like a better view than some people who actually live right on the sand, because you're kind of looking at the whole neighborhood. You're seeing the whole city in a lot of ways. So I'm going to put that on the roof of my house. I'm going to put one of those right over the master bedroom. And I'm going to put a circular staircase in the master bedroom so that you can only get up to the roof by way of the master bedroom on a circular staircase, boom, up, bang, there you are. Hot tub, wet bar, barbecue. I don't know about a fire pit. I don't know how, there's going to have to be gas up there anyway to heat the damn hot tub, right? Or is it a situation where you're using electricity? I have no idea. I have no idea on how hot tubs are heated. I mean, I've had them in the past that generally it's gas, but I don't know. And I've made a decision. This is my decision. I got to live. You know, I've been doing my show for the very first time in my life 26 years ago. I said, I'm going to start doing this work. I'm going to start doing this radio stuff. I'm going to start doing this performance shit, whatever it is, as me. I'm going to express, I'm going to be me. You know, it's not like I have some burning need to be me. It's not like I, you know, step back world, because I have to be me. You know, I don't think I'm that wonderful. But if I'm going to take up space on this planet, I might as well do the best I can. Right? So, I do my radio show, I do my work as authentically as I can. And I got to start to live that way too. I got to start to live authentically. I got to tell you, at the height of my earning, I always thought of myself as a Malibu Canyon kind of a guy, you know. And, you know, 3 acres, 4 acres. And, oh, I don't know, you know, 7,000 square feet. Like Bobby Dooley, you know, I was living like Bobby Dooley. And I got to tell you, I was as far away from who I was in those days as I could get. I look at a picture of myself then. First of all, I was like 8,000 pounds, you know. And secondly, I was wearing clothes I wouldn't be caught dead in. Bowling shirts, slacks, this kind of shit. And thirdly, living, for me, extravagantly. I just felt it was extravagant. And what I've decided to do is to live authentically, which is I like to live well, but I'm also a kind of a guy that likes houses that are built partially underground, that kind of shit. You know, I like to live well, but I love a house that's circular. You know, my favorite houses in the world are up in Mendocino, all the artist colony up there. There's houses up there that are partially underground. They're built like turrets. It's goofy. It's crazy. It's beautiful. I love it. And it's not who I am, but it's, if you're going to ask me to pick something out of a collection of things that you put in your house, generally it would be the weirdest thing. I'd pick the surreal thing. My favorite art is surreal art. And I can't even tell you the names of the artists, but I've seen things that I would hang. I would spend top dollar for this. I saw one painting. It was a guy in a sailboat cutting through the waves, right? You don't really cut through waves in a sailboat. You ride over the waves. But there he is. He's in a sailboat, and he's sort of riding these waves. Fairly choppy day, but he's got control of the ship. And then you look, and you see where he is. He's riding. He's in a sailboat, and he's going through the waves. He's in a gigantic sink. It's a bathroom sink. And there's a huge faucet. I said, I got to have that.
Yes, sir. That'll be $6,000.
I can't lay that kind of money. Although I've been with people who lay out that kind of... Maybe I have to start. I don't know. I mean, God knows artists are entitled to their living, too. Dropping 10, 15 G's for a painting is... I better put that sucker... It better be, like, prominent. Like, the biggest goddamn thing in the room. You know, like, bam! See that? Yeah, 15 G's for that. I'd tell everybody what I paid for it. Oh, I love your... Yeah, 15,000. Oh, I didn't. Yes. Uh-huh. See that? There's a woman there at the hearth. 20 grand. Well, and that's not the most money you can spend for something like that. And God damn it, if they don't deserve it. Because I've told you guys a million times. When we went and saw Howard Finster in North Georgia, the great artist who is considered a primitive, like Grandma Moses, you know? And what a primitive is someone who didn't have formal art training. They didn't have any, there's no formal tuition there. They didn't go to art school. They just one day picked up a pencil or paper or a pen and started drawing shit and just happened to be brilliant. It happened to be entirely unique and meaningful. Everything that art critics say is cool, you know? Well, you don't believe. Look at the lines. Look at this and the texture and what is and the statement. You know, Howard Finster is one of those artists, and he did album covers for Talking Heads. He did ads for Stolichnaya. You gradually, it'll jar your memory if you think back. All these little figures that were diving into the lakes of fire and shit. He's very, or was, I should say, very religiously motivated. I think Mr. Finster was a minister of some kind, a reverend, a preacher. I think he was of the a man of the cloth. And I met him. And I was with a friend of mine, Tory Ryder. We went up to North Georgia. Tory had just bought one of his paintings in Little Five Points in Atlanta, which is sort of a art, you know, the art district, like Greenwich Village in New York. Little Five Points is where all the artists hang. And we went to this gallery. And she bought one of his paintings, 8 G's, 9 G's, 10 G's, I forget what it was. And we had this thing, and the guy in the gallery said, you like Howard Finster? Yes. Well, you can go visit him. He said, you're kidding. No, not at all. He's in this address. He gave us the address. Oh, yeah, go up there. So we went up. We took the painting, got in the car, and took off and went up to North Georgia. It was about a two-hour drive. And we got to his house, and as we pulled down the street of this little primitive artist, a man who's just sitting and living authentically. That's what I mean. You're living authentically. You know, this is who I am. I'm not trying to put on airs. It's what I am. And on his street were cars parked, you know, down the street, because I guess there wasn't a time when he didn't have visitors, and they had New Hampshire plates, and they had Colorado plates, and there was a place from New York, and plates from Texas. They were coming from all over the country to see him, and he sort of held court there for about 2 hours, and then his nephew, who was standing behind, said, okay, my uncle's had enough for today. Get out. No, he didn't say that, but he definitely said, you know, it's over. Times the visitation hours are over. So that's what we did, and that's about as authentic as you can get, you know. And I talked to him. I said, so now you are on a Stolichnaya ad. He says, oh, yeah, yeah. I got that in, see? I got my message through. I'm a teetotaler. He doesn't drink, or didn't drink. He's passed on, rest his soul. He said, I don't drink. But the Stolichnaya people, that's liquor, that's vodka, see? But I got my message in, see? So I pulled one over. I pulled the wool over on them. You know? And I don't doubt that on a certain level he did, but not that the Stolichnaya people didn't know that he was a teetotaler. Maybe they were pulling one over on him, you know? Look at this. We got a guy that doesn't drink, and he's doing a spot. He's doing an art for our back page of freaking Esquire. What do you think of that? So I guess that's synergy, as they say, right? And then he had a picture in his kitchen, a Polaroid of him standing with the Talking Heads. With Talking Heads, and he said, they were great kids, great kids. I did an album cover for them. Fine young people. And there he was with David Byrne, a whole group. And then we got in the car, and we said, okay. Oh, and then Tori said, would you please sign, I just purchased one of your paintings. Well, now, dig what happened. He said, yes, I'd be happy to sign it. He says, I'll sign, and he was going to sign the front. He was going to sign his name over the painting itself. And she said, and Tori balked. She said, oh, my God, no, please don't. Would you sign the back? Oh, well, and I don't know if I said it or she said it or he said it, but the thought became very clear. If he signs the front of this painting, it becomes a completely unique painting. It becomes another work of art, completely unique to her painting. Tori would have the only one of its kind until he wound up signing somebody else's. But I mean, how many could there be? And that thought kind of struck and it took hold. And she rethought it. She said, no, go ahead, sign the front. So he did. So somewhere there in her collection of art, in her massive collection of art there in San Francisco, you know, her multi-million dollar, I'm joking, but she's got Howard Finster, you know, his name on the front of her painting. Well, I'm going to go now.
I'm going to go now.
And I'm really grateful that you spent a little bit of money with me. And I thought that this would be a cool way of doing things. Instead of a show, it being Monday Memorial Weekend, you know, all right, we'll just kick here and we'll just talk, man. I mean, just talk. I'll tell you what's up with me. And we'll see if we don't do something else tomorrow. I'm sure we will. This is the Phil Hendry Show. Our website is philhendryshow.com. Please, 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 please give us a follow on Snapchat, Phil Hendry. That's it, P-H-I-L-H-E-N-D-R-I-E on Snapchat. And you can follow me at Real Phil Hendry. That's Real Phil Hendry on Twitter. And Phil Hendry Fans, P-H-A-N-S, on Facebook. And when we start jumping into some of the other social media centers, I'll let you know. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, those are enough for now anyway. Okay? Talk to you guys tomorrow. Thanks. Phil Hendry Show is executive produced by me, Phil Hendry, for Siempre Incorporated. All of our rights are reserved. And we're on the great, great, great platform. It's owned, operated, run, and run successfully by another, I should say, great broadcast genius, Norm Pattiz. We're on Podcast One.